A few months ago on Fresh Air, journalist James Adams warned us that although the arms race between the U.S. and the Soviet Union was winding down, there was another arms buildup threatening world peace. Dictators in developing countries were building their arsenals, including chemical and biological weapons. Today, Adams joins us from London to discuss Iraq's arsenal. Adams is defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and the author of the book Engines of War, Merchants of Death and the New Arms Race. I asked him how Iraq developed their chemical weapons.
With a great deal of help from a number of Western countries, West Germany, for example, Austria, for example, France, for example, they've managed to piece together, using an overt and underground network of buying, to purchase the wherewithal both to manufacture and to build the capability for chemical and biological weapons, bearing in mind that these many chemical weapons have a base of agricultural and fertilizer type products, which with some variation you can turn into very deadly weapons. But the companies and the countries that supplied the equipment knew, I think, perfectly well what they were doing. But as so often happens in the arms business, it was a chance to make a buck or two, and no one looked at the consequences down the road, which, of course, the U.S. forces are now facing.
You've made the point in the past that chemical weapons are the equivalent of nuclear weapons for third world dictators. Do you think that the situation now illustrates your point?
Absolutely, because chemical weapons are very deadly. They are non-persistent in the sense that you can throw a chemical weapon into an area, kill the people who it affects, and if you have a non-persistent chemical, one that doesn't last very long, your own forces can go into the same territory minutes, hours, days later, depending on what the type you use. So as a war weapon, it is much more effective, and in terms of kills or bangs for your buck, or however one wants to phrase the awfulness of a particular type of weapon, chemicals are terrible, and their effect is not much different, in fact very similar to a tactical nuclear weapon.
What do you think the lesson is in Iraq about what our arms policy should be?
I think the key lessons that we have learned, which to some extent we already knew, but it's brought it more harder to home, is in the chemical and nuclear area, because one of the things that is driving everyone forward in this crisis is the capability that Iraq has to use both chemical weapons now and nuclear weapons at a time in the not too distant future. Now that's arisen because nations have been feeble in prosecuting embargoes on nuclear and chemical capability. Governments have turned a blind eye to the export of material that allows nations to develop that kind of capability. And the clear lesson from that is that we must be more stringent about this whole business in the future. Because if you take away chemical and nuclear capability, what do you have left in Saddam Hussein except a rather low-level dictator with a lot of conventional military force that could be dealt with really without too much trouble with a fairly long-term campaign? But you can't allow a dictator like that, with the clear territorial ambitions he has, to remain in power if he is at the one time going to have a nuclear capability. You simply can't allow it. And there are plenty of other nations lining up to get this kind of capability as well. So it is a clear and harsh lesson to us all.
I wonder if you think it's almost too late in a way to stop the development of arsenals in third world dictatorships. So many dictators have huge arsenals now, in part because the superpowers helped arm them. If the superpowers stop arming them now, they still got lots of weapons.
I think that's absolutely right. And the worrying thing about the development in third world nations of this kind of capability is that, unlike among the superpowers, either in West or East, there is a clear willingness to use the weapons that they have. They're not frightened of upsetting another country or destabilizing the world. They're quite prepared to use what they have. So part of the strategic equation, if you like, of what's going on in the Gulf is to say to these other countries, OK, you may have this capability, but you want to use this, you watch out, because you know if you do so, there will be retribution, and that retribution will probably mean your own demise. So it is an important signal that is being sent through what is going on out in the Middle East to countries all over the world. Maybe that's the right way of doing it. It's a bit late in the day, but it is a way of dissuading countries that might otherwise use their weapons from doing so.
Well, the Soviet Union is sure in an unusual position now. It still has a little less than 200 military advisors in Iraq, and yet it's an ally with the United States and England in opposing Iraq's invasion of Kuwait.
Yes, but I think one needs to be slightly more sophisticated than simply looking at that headline, in that the Soviets have been extremely helpful to the United States in supplying accurate and timely intelligence on Iraq's military capability and on the current deployments. Now, one assumes, one doesn't know, but one assumes that some of those military advisors are of being of some assistance in this current crisis, although nobody clearly talks about that because the Soviets don't want them to be held hostage along with everybody else. So I think the Soviets have been much more helpful than simply having a number of advisors still in Iraq.
Alliances are changing in the Middle East, and Secretary of State James Baker is in Damascus. Syria has been on the United States blacklist of states sponsoring terrorism. Now it looks like Syria is becoming an ally in the Middle East. Do you think that this means that America and possibly England will in the future be supplying Syria with weapons?
Well, Syria is a very interesting state of affairs. If you go back 3 or 4 years, you could substitute Iraq for Syria. Iraq at war with Iran and a bigger enemy of the United States than Iraq had once been. Iraq a sponsor of terrorism, but through political convenience, people decided that Iraq was actually an okay place and US could have diplomatic relations and help them with intelligence against the Iranians and so on. Now here we are, the Syrians, having played rather a skillful game, committed troops to Saudi Arabia to fight against the horrible Saddam Hussein. So there goes James Baker off to Damascus, and no doubt the Brits will do the same thing. But it would be useful to remember the lesson of Iraq. Now, President Assad has always been a devious, ruthless, extremely brutal dictator who is only after the interests of himself and his country, which should not necessarily coincide with the interests of the United States. The fact that it does now is one thing. Whether we should actually get into bed with him and forget all past wrongdoing, I think would be, if history is anything to go by, a very, very rash mistake.
You wrote a book called Secret Armies about covert forces being trained. And I wonder if you think there are covert forces that Americans don't know about that are being deployed now in the Middle East.
Well, I'm never quite sure what people know about, but the current deployment of special forces, covert forces, if you like, to the Middle East is the biggest deployment, I think, seen certainly since Vietnam, and indeed special forces in the US are probably more effective now than they were in Vietnam. So you've got around 500 sea air land team folk from the Navy whose job it is to clear the way for invasion force by sea and to do reconnaissance. You've got members of the intelligence support activity, which is a unit designed to operate behind enemy lines or behind potential enemy lines, some of whom have infiltrated into Kuwait and are passing back fairly useful intelligence about where landings could or could not take place, the disposition of Iraqi forces and that kind of thing. So there is a great deal of activity, and when the shooting starts there will be far more activity, which perhaps might not be helpful to go into, as I'm sure the Iraqis will be listening to this program when it goes out.
You say when the shooting starts, you sound pretty sure that there's going to be shooting?
I find it very difficult to conceive of a situation where Saddam Hussein is going to withdraw from Kuwait and give up his chemical and nuclear capabilities. And I don't believe that sanctions will force him to do anything. And indeed, sanctions in the end, when children start to starve, or even if they don't starve, I'm sure that Saddam Hussein will bring them out on television and say they're starving, then the Allied will to proceed will start to fall away. So I think that for every reason, military, political, tactical, strategic, I think war is inevitable. And I think we should resign ourselves to the consequences of that.
When you say war is inevitable, what kind of war are you envisioning?
Well, war, of course, in any form is terrible, but in the way that this one could be fought, the casualties might be relatively low. The Americans might lose under 5,000, might lose well under 5,000. The Iraqis might lose 20 to 30,000. You would fight, if they fight according to the way they would want to fight, the Americans would, or the Allied forces, would attack the air power of the Iraqis, plus their chemical and nuclear capability, degrade their radar and radio communications, invade and take Kuwait City, establish a bridgehead to block and cut off the supply lines south for the Iraqi forces, and then use the air power, which is enormous, to destroy, comprehensively destroy, the Iraqi forces at the front, so that the Iraqis could not move forward. U.S. ground forces would not have to be engaged apart from in mopping up operations. It would be a devastating but short war.
James Adams, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Adams is the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and author of Engines of War, Merchants of Death, and the New Arms Race.